Enter, if you dare.
Hello, welcome once again to Dark Discussions, your place for the discussion of horror, film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I'm one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the U.S. of A., and with me in the state of New York.
Hi, this is Mike.
Mike, how's it going?
I'm fine, Phil. How are you?
Doing all right. We also have a Connecticut American.
This is Chrissy.
Chrissy, how are you?
I am doing amazing.
Excellent. All right, so a couple things first. For folks who are new to the Dark Discussions podcast, what we are and what we do. Basically, Dark Discussions is a podcast that talks about films. We critique and review, so not just review and not just critique. We try to do both, dissect and discuss films for our genre, our horror, sci-fi, fantasy, thrillers, techno-thrillers, mysteries, grindhouse, arthouse, and whatnot. So basically, cult films, geek films, whatever you want to say. We do have a couple places you can get involved. The first, you can email darkdiscussions@aol.com, where we will read your email on the podcast, and we do have some emails tonight. And you can also join Dark Discussions Podcast Facebook group. So over there, there's a lot of discussions about various things. The Invisible Man is being discussed. They're still talking about last year's best films, where we have things on Harley Quinn because of that movie, Sonic the Hedgehog. So we're talking about video game movies and comic book movies over there too. So there's a lot of good discussions, and you can join the discussion, or you can create your own topic and get involved. Now, Mike, we do have a website.
Yeah, the website is Dark Discussions, www.darkdiscussions.com, spelled just like it sounds. And on that website, you will find links to every episode of the Dark Discussions, every episode the Dark Discussions has ever done before. Just go to Dark Discussions, click on audio, there's the podcast, and there are currently 426 episodes, plus a few special episodes here and there. So I would say it's somewhere around 435 episodes, maybe, or close to it, for you to watch. Actually, about 430. And then there's links to our other spinoff podcasts, such as Cinema a la Carte, Bullets, Brothels, and Bots, You Know Nothing, Jon Snow, Searching for American Gods, and Halloween Boutique, Psychotronic Reviews. Also, back on the homepage, we've incorporated a few not spin-off podcasts, what would you call them, sister podcasts, or...
Yeah, network podcasts, Dark Discussion Network
podcasts. That we are very happy to have joined us, that would be Fishnets and Phantoms, and what's the other one that's joined us? It's really slow loading right now, and I can't see. Oh, Anthony T's Horror Show is another, and what was the last one?
Darkest Before Dawn.
That's it. I apologize. I really apologize. And I'm going to be perfectly fair. I haven't listened to that podcast yet, so I haven't heard it. But it's on the Dark Discussions Network, so you know it's got to be not terrible.
Also, Mike, there's a new one that's possibly joining us within the next 2 weeks or so, and that would be our friend Holly Masiak's podcast.
Oh, right. Oh, and what was that one called?
I think Eric may know, and Eric just joined us. Eric, do you remember
Eric!
Holly? Eric! Do you know Holly's podcast?
Save us!
I do. It's Horror Melee.
Thank you! That's it. Okay.
And I have to admit...
Yeah, my Alzheimer's brain remembers nothing anymore.
I joined right as he threw it to Mike to do the website spiel, and I almost said I was here so I could do it, but then I decided to let Mike give it a shot.
He's doing a good job. He's
doing a good job. He's doing all right. Yeah, so anyway, so you go there, and you can find all that. You can find some articles that Eric and... others have written, but we're a little out of date. We might want to start bringing some more in, because the last one was...
we need to write some more stuff.
Ooh, wow. Okay, was from co-host Eric, appreciating movies on their own merits, and that was in January of 2018. So yeah, maybe we should consider. You know what? Here's the thing. If you have an idea, you know, because send an idea and say, could you write about this, we'd be more than happy to. You know, but
well, also, we're also, Mike, we're willing to take articles if people want to write about horror films or genre films or cult films, their own review, their opinion on a director, you know, whatever. We'll take them and we'll post them up.
Yeah,
as long as they're on topic. Yes.
Yeah, and we'll split with you half the profits from each episode of the podcast.
Zero. But Mike, or actually, let's move
that means
on.
You have to pay us.
That's
yes,
true.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Because we're in the red. Yes. One last thing, Eric. Let's go to Eric because he has a good spiel for this Patreon or something, Eric.
Wow. Okay. Sure. we have a Patreon account. Patreon is a service that allows you to financially support your online artists like podcasters. Producing the show is not free. We have to pay for things like server hosting and the web page and going to see movies and replacing Phil's shitty computers. So all of that costs money. If you'd like to help us offset that cost, you can follow the link on darkdiscussions.com front and center, or you can go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions. For every $5 a month that you care to donate to help us, you will have the opportunity to submit a topic for us to possibly do an episode on. We take all the submissions from our patrons and draw them randomly on a quarterly basis and choose one topic to do a show on. So for more information, you can go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions or go to the link on darkdiscussions.com.
Excellent. Very good. Very good. All right. So speaking of some emails, we did have an email. And Chrissy, you have it in front of you to read us. I think there's two of them.
Yes, I do. We have two emails from Amy Rainey, who is not only a listener, she also has her own podcast. Here we go. Fishnets and Phantoms. Did I get it right? And I actually listened to it and I'm having trouble remembering it, the name. But it's a great podcast, so you should definitely check it out. She has written us a couple of emails about our episode, our bucket list episode. And in the beginning of this first email, she talks about the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari before moving on to some other topics that we discussed on our bucket list episode, which if you have not listened to, you may head to our archives page. And Phil, do you remember the date on that or the episode number on that? I don't have it in front of me.
But it was in December.
It was in December. So just scroll down to the bottom, toward the bottom of the list on our archives page, and you'll find it. Okay, so here we go. Hi, guys. Loved this episode, though I had to try to yell answers at the computer, LOL. I am a big fan of the German Expressionist art movement. Expressionist, not Impressionist. Think of the painting The Scream versus Monet's Water Lilies. The German cinema was amazing, as was the art movement in general, and it is one of my favorite subjects. Expressionism was a reaction to the horrors of World War I and the feeling that the world had gone mad in general. It was also a reaction to the incredibly bad economic situation Germany was in after the war. Bread went from 250 marks to 200 trillion marks in 10 months. There are photos of people with wheelbarrows of cash going to the market. Phil, I know you know a lot of this. So the symbolist look of Caligari was intentional, not only to capture the artist movement's influence on the film, but also to hint to audiences the dream nature of the plot. Also during that time, people were contending with the birth and, well, toddlerhood of modernity. How do you even say that, guys? That's a tough word. I believe it's pronounced modernity, but if I'm wrong, you can feel free to send me an email.
I'd go with that pronunciation myself.
Yeah, I think so. Telephones, film, and radios, which were unimaginable communication revolutions, were now ubiquitous. Hollywood went towards realism. Germany followed its more avant-garde art scene and used expressionist and other artistic movements' looks. Before World War II, Germany was known as the land of poets, artists, and scholars. The German version of Hollywood was Babelsberg. While expressionist cinema is famous, the more normal subjects of romance, comedy, and drama were also popular at the time. We have Germany to thank for most of the technical aspects of film and its availability to regular people. Max and Emil Gladanowski invented the bioscope film projector, predating the more famous Lumiere brothers' cinematography projector. One of the most form movies in Germany was a horror film. One of the first long-form movies in Germany was a horror film. 1913's A Student of Prague from Edgar Allan Poe. You guys wondered how many theaters there were in 1920. I read that by 1910, there were 1,000 in Germany and 2,000 by 1916. Here is a fun personal story. Nosferatu was judged to be plagiarism of Dracula and ordered to be destroyed. Of course, people hid copies because it was cool. Apparently, one reel of it was lost for decades and thought to be gone forever. My friend Eric Levin was friends with a couple of hoarder film buffs. One day he went to his friend's house and they were talking in the kitchen. He looked down into the kitchen sink and there was a film can. He picked it up and was like, "Hey, do you have the rest of this?" His friend was like, "Yeah," and excavated it, so Eric bought it. Yeah, the sink film was the missing bit of Nosferatu. He proceeded to restore the film and have the cards translated and rewritten, and now it is considered, I believe, the definitive version. I think he sold it some years back to Kino. His other acquaintance had a lost print of Thomas Edison's Frankenstein. He was very averse to loaning any of his possessions out, but Eric to the rescue again was able to convince him to let him show it at his theater. It is very short. I was able to see the premiere of it at the Avalon Cinema. He also somehow got it transferred to video, so it should be easily findable now or here. And she gives a YouTube link. So you're going to go to https://YouTube, which is YouTube, which is YOUTUBE/capital letters YKTTP9A J is lowercase 8 R is capital and E is capital. I was also able to see the only existing copy of the beautiful robotic form of Maria from Metropolis at our art museum a few years ago. Hitler was both entranced by movies as well as enraged by their messages. Many irreplaceable artifacts were destroyed, and many artists, Marlene Dietrich, Peter Lorre, Fritz Lang, Bertolt Brecht, etc., fled to America when Hitler came to power. However, not all made it out. I highly, highly recommend you all see Metropolis, and M, starring Peter Lorre in his best role. Oh, and Trip to the Moon is by the delightful George Millet, who is the grandfather of special effects. There recently was a successful campaign to save his gravesite, which was in disrepair. Again, I recommend watching his short, innovative films. Here is one. And then she gives another YouTube link. Same prefix as before. And the last digits are capital N, as in Nancy, capital Q, capital Y, capital B as in boy, lowercase x, lowercase c, capital D as in dog, capital J, 7, 3, lowercase W. I apologize to, is it Eric, who dislikes history digressions? I am a digression queen. And then her second email addresses a little bit of a different point from the same episode. Hi, guys. I just want to put a bit of emphasis on the concept of gaslighting as someone who has had it done to them. Gaslighting could be as harmless as moving knickknacks around, but usually if someone is referring to it, it's part of mental and emotional abuse where the perpetrator undermines the victim's actual sense of reality, and it is very damaging, especially combined with physical abuse. It grinds down the victim's will and sense of self. Think of the guy who convinces his kid that he beat up his mom and him because he cried when his puppy died. Or the wife of a friend who convinces her husband she had to cheat on him because he isn't manly enough and he was trying to tell her it was okay by eating vegetables. People suck. So that is those are Amy's emails. I apologize for fumbling on some of the
Christy?
Pronunciations. Yeah.
Christy, I admire your dedication to reading the YouTube links. That was amazing.
Thank you. I was like, well, I just got to slow down and, you know, but thank you very much. So, yes. And on the topic of gaslighting, I will definitely be.
It might come up again. Yeah.
It might come up again this evening. And I will definitely go into depth about it because I have had it done to me many times, including recently. So I'm ready, man. I'm going to have a field day with this fucker tonight.
I thought you would.
Yes, I am. All right. So anyway, that's it.
All right. Very good. Thank you, Amy, for your thoughts. That was a fun episode that we did. I'm glad that you were able to add additional opinions and information on the topics we discussed in that episode. What other things did we have? I think that was pretty much it on that account. So I think we're apt to get into our topic, but one thing before that, today's date is March 5th, 2020. We are recording this episode for folks who are curious. I'm speaking to you, Pam. Now, let's get into our topic tonight. So, Eric, what are we going to discuss tonight?
Tonight, we are going to be talking about a movie currently in theaters. It's getting very good reviews. Last I checked, I had an 80% in Rotten Tomatoes. Starring Elizabeth Moss, depending on how you want to look at it, it's either an adaptation of an H.G. Wells story or it's a remake of a 1933 movie, The Invisible Man.
As the attorney representing Adrian's trust, I'm required to read a prepared statement. Cecilia, although our relationship was far from perfect, I thought that you would talk to me rather than run away.
Are you okay? What happened to him?
He cut his wrists. Per his final wishes, you're getting $5 million. Contingent, of course, on the fine print.
He can't be ruled to be mentally incompetent.
It just doesn't make any sense.
What?
Adrian wouldn't kill himself.
Listen. You're getting your freedom back, okay? Don't let him haunt you.
Hello? I'm scared.
You don't have to be scared of him anymore.
He was a sociopath, completely in control of everything. He said that wherever I went, he would find me. Walk right up to me. And I wouldn't be able to see him.
Are you okay?
Someone's sitting in that chair. I found something that can prove what I'm experiencing.
You need help. Adrian is dead.
I went to his house today. He's not dead.
I have a pile of ashes in a box that would disagree with you.
He has figured out a way to be invisible.
Only thing more brilliant than inventing something that makes you invisible is coming up with the perfect way to torture you, even in death. Adrian's true genius was how he got in people's heads.
Don't come any closer. Hey!
I'm not crazy. Please listen to me.
You're saying the person trying to kill you is in the room right now. But we can't see him?
He's listening. Where are you?
Where are you? Show yourself! Come on! Do it!
There you are.
That's right. It's actually at 91% right now.
Oh, no cow. Wow. That's been a long day.
That's all right. 298 critical reviews and it has 91% good reviews. The film is obviously the original product was The Invisible Man, the novel by H.G. Wells, one of the greatest authors of all time, which was made into a film starring Claude Rains. And then this is a reimagining of I guess, like you said, are either book or film, or basically you probably have to say the book, because that was where it started. This film here is directed by Lee Whannell. Lee Whannell is probably best known as the writer of Saw, the movie series, but he also directed and written many other films, including the film Upgrade, which was a topic on Dark Discussions just a year or two ago. This is his third film now that he's directed, but he's written about 10 films prior. He's an Australian. The film stars what's the woman's name, Eric?
Elizabeth Moss,
that's right.
Elizabeth Moss, she played Peggy on Mad Men. That's where I know her from, but other people,
and
I'm sure.
She's also the lead in Handmaid's Tale.
Yep.
That's right. Yeah. Also of note in the film is Michael Dorman, who's been in a number of genre films, including films that we've done on this podcast, including Triangle and Acolytes. He's an Australian actor.
That's where I recognized him from. Okay.
Yes, exactly. This film was made in Australia, so there's a lot of the extras supporting roles are Australian folk. Also not starring, but in the movie are Aldis Hodge, Storm Reid, Harriet Dyer, Olivia Jackson-Cohen, and whatnot. Basically, the film is a Blumhouse film, so it's another film that was made on a minuscule budget of $7 million. World box office right now, after 1 week, is $55.9 million. Not surprising, based off of the good reviews. And this is a standalone film, and though it's a Universal film, it is not part of the Dark Universe that they kind of have folded and made disappear. So that's all I got. So we can discuss how the film was made and how Lee Whannell got involved and so on and so forth. But that will be during our critique and all that. Before we get into all that, I guess we can talk about what we thought about this film and how we heard about it. So I guess we can start with you, Chrissy.
Okay. I heard about this because I think I saw a trailer somewhere. I saw this on Tuesday night. And it was my first time in a Dolby theater, and in our movie theater, the Dolby theater is, this was an interesting experience for me, Eric, because I'd never been in one. I loved the cushy recliner. I loved the cushy seats, but initially I did not care for the sound that was so loud that I could literally feel it in my ass cheeks and my uterus was vibrating. And I was like, all right, I don't know if I could do 2 hours of this. I literally felt like it in my insides. However, I did get used to it. I really did. And I think this is actually a fantastic film to see in the Dolby format, because there are prolonged periods of silence in this where you really need to listen. And I think the sound design in this is very impressive, and it's key, especially in the first half of the film, when we're only clue that something is amiss, to try to keep it spoiler free, is the heightened sound. You know, you'll hear like a tiny creak somewhere. It's really very effective. I really enjoyed this movie. I am so impressed in general with what Blumhouse has been putting out lately. I think they're not only putting out fresh material, but they are taking other properties like Fantasy Island and even Invisible Man. And they're not updating them really, but they're doing interesting things so that they have a modern sensibility and we're not getting the same old tropes, but it's almost like they're taking the concept and using that concept to tell an original story. I think Fantasy Island was a little bit closer to the TV show, but it did definitely go to a little bit of a different place. With the Invisible Man, I thought This was wonderful use of the Invisible Man idea. It certainly has a very contemporary take, which I'll talk about later. But also, it's a very, this is a very human story. The subtext in here is amazing. We're dealing with themes centering on perseverance, confidence, victimization, trauma, loss, reinvention. I mean, this thing covers so many themes. There's got to be about 9 or 10 different themes in here. I thought the sound design was fantastic, as I already said. It definitely held together. I think that the use of three beats was fantastic. The use of weather to reinforce certain emotional tension in the film was also excellently done. I was on the edge of my seat at some points. I thought the tension was very well ratcheted, among them in the opening, where it just, you jump out of your seat. But it's not really a jump scare. It's really there for a reason. I just thought it was an excellent psychological thriller. The script is excellent. And this is going to be up there with some of my favorites this year. I thought Moss's performance was stunning. And I also thought, and this is rare that I would say this, the makeup actually in this was really well done. And the makeup was heightened by her acting. I mean, she looked like a battered soul at certain parts of the film. And when things were better, she looked healthy and lovely. And they even made her eyes and lips a little more true to what their real color would be, as opposed to being washed out. And I'm pretty sure that was all done with lighting and makeup. It was very well done. Also, however, I can identify with this material. I've been in relationships with narcissistic sociopaths. It's not fun. And I just want to point out, and I will say it again as we go through this, I am not a psychologist. I am not an expert on this in any way, shape, or form. But I am speaking from experience and from books I read to try to educate myself. And if there are listeners out there who do want to learn about this as we start, or as I start mentioning some things that were excellently done, I mean, whoever wrote this script, I swear to God, has lived with a narcissist or dealt with a narc, because my God, they nailed it. They really did. There are loads of wonderful books on the subject written by very qualified people out there. And if you do suspect that someone in your life is a narc and you are a victim, you should probably start making plans to get away from that toxic individual, even if it is not physical abuse, because as Amy pointed out in her email, a lot of times it's the verbal and the emotional that really destroys you as a human being. And in this movie, we see that although she was also Elizabeth Moss, Cecilia, I think is the character's name, was clearly physically abused. I think that's pretty obvious. It was really the emotional and the verbal damage that really did a bigger number on her. So anyway, those are my thoughts. I think this is an excellent movie. And I hope we're going to talk a little bit about that article in The Hollywood Reporter later, what the Invisible Man left behind, because I don't know what that guy's on crack. Like, I don't know what his problem is that he thinks it needs to be like the original. So anyway, that's it.
All right. Very good. Yeah. Lee Wano, the director, also was the sole writer of the script. All right, let's go to you, Eric.
I can't remember how I initially heard about this. It was on radar for a while. I took the opportunity to watch the original The Invisible Man the night before I went to see this, because I'd actually never seen that one before. I found it very interesting to compare the two movies. They're very different. I actually really enjoyed what Lee Wanell did to update the story and use some modern themes. I enjoyed all the aspects of the movie that Chrissy was just highlighting, the sound design, some of the themes involved. You know me and my stupid brain that won't shut off. I did have some logical issues with some of the plot elements, which I'll get into later. But overall, I thought it was a very well-made movie. Elizabeth Moss is a fantastic actress. I really liked some of the stuff they did in this movie. But I think, in my personal opinion, it's a little overrated at the moment. I think it's gotten a little overhyped, but it's still a very, very good movie that I recommend. So I'll give more details later. But yeah, it's a good movie. Getting a little hyperbole right now.
All right, very good. Mike.
Yeah, we saw this on Sunday, opening weekend.
We meaning you and Pam?
My wife and I, yes. Good point. Yeah, so my wife and I saw this. We both liked a lot. My wife and I have watched Mad Men, and we both really like the character of Peggy. My wife also likes Handmaid's Tale, which I haven't had a chance to catch up with because I just tend to forget that we subscribe to Hulu and don't often click on it. So I haven't caught on that. But I do like Elizabeth Moss as an actress, and I thought she was wonderful in this. One thing I'll say is I'm a fan of the original. I just watched it a couple of months ago. I think James Whale was way ahead of a lot of his the contemporary directors that were making these films. I think Frankenstein, Invisible Man, which he directed, both stand up kind of head and shoulders above a lot of the others.
The effects in The Invisible Man are fucking amazing for 1933.
Oh, absolutely incredible. But I think Eric will agree with me that this is a very different interpretation.
But I like them both.
Oh, yeah, and this is not a knock on it, but I'm very glad, unlike some people on this podcast, I'm very glad that I had seen the trailer for this ahead of time, because it is such a, in many ways, a different take, and I probably would have reacted a little differently had I gone in expecting a more faithful take, I guess, on the original version. Meaning, if you the character Griffin in the original version is kind of a megalomaniac, right? He's there's a little bit of a trap element to the character, and it is very much focused on that character, but he has like delusions of grandeur and commits grand acts of homicide, like causing, I think, a train to crash and stuff like that, where this is a much smaller and more personal film.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Cause it's basically going back to the letter from earlier and going back to our, bucket list episode at the beginning of the year. It's basically an Invisible Man meets Gaslight episode, film. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what they do, so taking that and being able to take it on its own terms, which is really what you should be doing with every film, taking the film on its own terms, I think it's really well done. I think it takes the idea of an Invisible Man and milks the concept really well. I think Elizabeth Moss really does give a great performance, and a lot of kudos to her for being willing. She hasn't done a lot of films. She's done some, but this might be the first like mainstream big film, if you want to call it a big film, that she's anchoring.
Well, she had a small role in Get Out.
Yeah, but it was a small role, right? And yep. And she was like the
do
star.
You mean
of the
Us, Phil?
Yeah,
Get Out. Right. I meant Us, not Get Out.
Okay.
Yeah,
right, but like I didn't realize she was even in Us until we went to see it. Or I didn't remember that she was in Us. And so here she's the star. She's front and center. And she allows herself to look terrible throughout the movie.
I know. I like that about her.
Oh, absolutely.
She does that in The Handmaid's Tale, too.
Right. And a lot of actresses will not let that happen. And actors, too. I don't want to just single them out. Will, you know, be very reluctant to look bad. You know, there may even be, like, certain superstar action people who are afraid to stand next to other actors because they're so short. They don't want to be revealed for their tininess.
We won't mention any names.
No, but there are definitely some actors that are just, you know, cruising on their action image. Again, you mentioned the makeup. The makeup is great. The acting is great. I think this reminded me a lot of, especially in the early bits, a lot of It Follows, in the way that Wan-El uses sort of the negative space in the screen to constantly get your eyes looking for something that may or may not be there.
Yes.
and turns it into a very interactive game with the audience.
Makes cliches and then turns out they're not even there. He was just tricking us.
Right. And again, it is a different take on the Invisible Man. I know one of the things I'd been thinking about is what would I do if I wanted to do sort of an Invisible Man thing? And there was more of this in there than I thought. But I like one of the things I thought is that you could use this. You know, we live in a world where anonymity is a thing. Right. I mean, we have being that you get to sit behind the your computer and you can say and do almost anything you want without anybody knowing you are who you are. Unless, of course, somebody's watching your camera on your computer. That's a whole different matter. And as a result of that, a lot of people are assholes, right? There are people who say and do things on social media or on the internet or in comment sections on news articles that they would never say in real life. And there's some of that here. There's some of how technology is always watching us. So part of it was thinking that I would probably have tried to do technology, because the original Invisible Man coming sort of at the middle of the age of the chemistry revolution, it's all the original story. He injects himself with chemicals and turns himself invisible. And I was thinking I would do maybe something more technological, and that's kind of where they go this way. But I really, you know, so I really like the film. I just think it's, and it does have a nice build to it, I think. It's kind of a slow burn for about an hour, and then it just kind of goes bug nuts at the end. And I liked that. Some people may not have appreciated the shift in tone and the faster pace. Yeah, there might be some plot issues. I'm sure we're going to hash them out because this is Dark Discussions, and we'll see if they hold up.
All right, very good. For me, I heard about it just following Lee Whannell to see what he was going to do next, because Lee Whannell is one of my favorite film director / screenwriter type folk, especially after Upgrade, though. Sinister was the film that, not Sinister, I'm sorry, Insidious was the film that really made me begin following him, because he wrote that film, and that film, I felt, scared the hell out of me. So I went in to the film. There was only two other folks in the theater. My experience was very stressful and anxiety because of the coronavirus, not the film. I was like panicking, like, did I touch my face? So I was like going nuts the whole time.
Are you OCD too?
No, but ever since the coronavirus, I am. I mean, just 2 weeks ago, I would say, yeah, there's no such thing as germs. And now everybody.
There hasn't been a single case in your state, Phil.
That's not true.
Oh, yeah. They're shutting down New Hampshire for good, if you haven't heard.
Yeah.
Phil, don't leave, Phil, because we don't want your coronavirus down here, okay? So please stay where you are.
Not comfortable, though. Well, I just went to church like 4 hours earlier, and the priest said, no one should shake hands anymore. I'm not going to be shaking hands. The bishops in Chicago agreed that the peace offering, we don't have to shake hands. So I didn't go up to get the host. I said, I can't do it. I can't do it. So I was like freaking the whole day, and still am to this day. So even with that anxiety, I tried to pay attention as best I could. And basically, I have to say that I did get the film in, and I thought it was a really great film. It was there with the VFW so far. So I've seen a couple of damn good films now, back to back, and with what's coming up with A Quiet Place 2 and stuff, I'm expecting that we're going to have some really good films coming. I really like this film a lot. Not much I can really add to, because most of the stuff that you guys said, the sound design, the acting, the set, and cinematography were really good. Lee Whannell is really a talent. He's just unbelievable director, can make small budget films into great films, and he's done it again here. I would highly recommend folks to see this film, and based off of what Chrissy and Eric said, especially with its sound design and what Mike said with the camera angles and the wide screen shots of like the kitchen or various rooms and whatnot, it's a really good film to see at the theaters, even
though you may not enjoy it if you have coronavirus fears as I do. High recommend. Big thumbs up. Yes.
You said that before this, you had never seen Elizabeth Moss in anything.
Except for Us. That's right, yeah.
Do you now believe she's a good actress?
Oh, I assume she would be, but I got to actually see her for the first time, and yeah, she's a good actress, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't watch TV. I watch only a handful of television programs like Ozark and Game of Thrones, whatever. So I don't know any television actors or actresses at all, basically. And so when people talk about, oh, yeah, this, and I go, I have no idea who that is. And so when I saw her in Us and people mentioned, oh, that's Elizabeth Moss, I was like, I have no idea. But now I got to see her at least in something. And yeah, she's a good actress. I never doubted she was, Eric. I think you misunderstood me, which is I don't know who she is.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you should. Now you do.
Yes. That's right. Yeah. So that's all I got to say. So I guess we can get into our wiki arc.
Wiki. All right. When Cecilia's abusive ex takes his own life and leaves her his fortune, she suspects his death was a hoax. As a series of coincidences turns, this is written poorly. As a series of coincidences turn lethal, Cecilia works to prove that she is being hunted by someone nobody can see. Maybe that wasn't working. Oh my god! I'm gonna stop talking now because my brain's not functioning. Take it away, Phil.
Yeah, I just want to say that folks who aren't familiar, as Mike mentioned, this isn't based off of the book or the original film series, specifically the first film. It's more of a reimagining of the book/film. So it's its own distinct story that really has nothing to do with the book or the movie from before.
I like where they went with it, though.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I did too, yeah. All right, so let's talk about some general things prior to spoilers and all that other good stuff. Eric, you understand what I'm saying, right? If you've never seen an actor or an actress, you have no idea if they're good or not, right?
Right.
Okay, I'm just making sure. I had never seen her. The supporting cast was pretty solid too, because I'd never seen any of the supporting cast either, except for Dorman, the guy that played the brother of the Invisible Man, and that's it. And so it was completely the whole cast was completely new to me, and it was interesting how a film. It's curious because maybe what you said, Mike, right? Stars don't matter anymore for films. Isn't that what you say, Mike?
As much as they used to. And it seems to be a matter of, like, you can take, a good example. Look at Dr. Doolittle that just came out. Robert Downey Jr. was gold as Iron Man and in Iron Man films. But he's had several flops since he started as Iron Man. And it's clear that people love Robert Downey Jr., as Iron Man. They're not as willing to go see Robert Downey Jr. in anything else. You have to get the right actor and not as willing. They'd say not willing, not as willing. It's a matter of the star has to really match the thing. There's not a lot of stars that open films the way they used to. Like, back in the 90s, if you had a Harrison Ford or a Tom Hanks in it, or Julia Roberts, it was guaranteed to open big.
Also the fact that films, aside from the Disney machine, films in general don't open like they used to.
That's true.
And really, it's not a matter of getting inspiration to go to the theater anymore so much as it is what's in front of me on my television. So I think that has something to do with it, too.
But you remember when for a while, you had a hot actor or someone. Another good example from the 90s, you needed The only thing you needed to open some movies in the 90s is that, what, or in the 80s, you had Arnold. In the 90s, it's a movie with Jim Carrey. People went to see it. Good, bad,
yeah,
or whatever.
True.
It was the name brought people in. You don't see that anymore, or if you do, it's not as much. I'm really hard-pressed to come up with somebody right now. You look at the budget of this film,
oh,
was $7
million. No, even the Rocks films don't necessarily make big money. Yeah.
Yeah. This is a budget film that had a $7 million budget. It used that budget wisely. It helps when one of the actors is never actually on the screen until, except for the beginning and end of the film. But they pay, it's clear to me that they just said, all right, where are we putting our money? Effects, Elizabeth Moss. And we're doing the rest. We're going to have a mostly unknown cast. And by unknown cast, I don't mean they haven't been in things you've seen. I mean that most people are not going to recognize the names. The names are not going over the title. The only one that does is Elizabeth Moss, because she's gotten recognition and awards for TV work. But she's still, again, you're talking about Mad Men and Handmaid's Tale, which critical darlings, but, you know, middle America has not seen, by and large.
Even anybody. I mean, it just depends, right? I mean, I'm not a middle American. I just haven't seen it because I don't have Hulu, and I didn't.
I mean, I'm referring to the average American.
Gotcha.
Who don't necessarily watch these series. I would say, I would guess, first of all, I know reading one of the articles with Lee and interviews with Lee Whannell, they talk about how much he gets out of his money. He said a lot of it's from filming in Australia, where you get a bigger bang for your buck.
That was a great article you posted, Mike.
Yeah. And then there was and the other thing is that I'm willing to bet Elizabeth Moss took points on the back end, meaning she's getting a percentage of the film's grosses as opposed to taking like a $10 million payday. And that probably
would she even get a $10 million payday? I mean, I don't think
It is. I mean, whatever she got, I'm sure she's getting a percentage, which kept the overall budget for the film down. And one of the things that spirals costs of films is that every actor with any clout wants to know what everybody else on the film is getting paid. And will have clauses that say, I can't be paid any less than this person or that person or what have you. Then the third build, you know, and so that keeps costs somewhat high if you're dealing with named actors. And I imagine if she didn't take a big salary for this, especially if she's getting a percentage cut, you save money in the beginning, and then shield. And there are a lot of actors doing this now for horror films, because horror films can be so profitable. They can make more money by just taking a low salary up front and taking the percentage of the cut over the long term. And there's a lot of actors now who are doing very well that way. But anyway, regardless, I'm glad to see her here. I thought she was really good.
I enjoyed, sorry, were you done?
No, I was, I guess. I didn't realize, but I was done.
All right. I enjoyed the updated premise, and I particularly enjoyed, I mean, I don't think it's too much of a spoiler to say it's the cause of invisibility is technological rather than chemical. I particularly liked how they yada 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 past any type of explanation of how it works. I thought that was a very wise decision, because if they'd had somebody try and give some clunky expedition as to how this invisibility suit works, that would have been a bummer. But the fact that they just showed it, it's like, okay, that's there, and it's a thing. And they didn't go any further than that. I thought that was a really good way to handle that.
I did too. Yeah.
The problem is reality is caught up with it, because we do have invisibility now. I mean, it maybe isn't as good as what we see in the film, mm-hmm. but it's a real thing, right?
No, the commercial before this movie in the theater was showing the feature on one of the Chevy trucks where it has like a rear view camera system where if you're hauling a trailer, the cameras show you what's behind the trailer, so it's essentially invisible to you.
Oh, but they developed, I think it was Japan, developed like a, I don't know, it's like a poncho or something that basically is see-through, you know? and I'm not referring to like, you know,
it's
the character.
It's called Saran Wrap, Mike.
No, where it's like, where again, it's sort of wrapping image around.
I thought it was Q in the last...
Yes.
Frost.
I'm very amused.
But anyway, and then something I did like when you do see the suit, and it's kind of studded with cameras. It just reminded me, and this maybe this was intentional, maybe not. There's a character from Greek mythology who was, I think, a henchman of Hera's called Argus of 100 Eyes. And it kind of made me think of this because it's covered with camera lenses. And it made me think of that. I have no idea if that, but that it's a character supposed to be always watching. And that is definitely a theme in this film, starting with the beginning, right? Where we're watching her and her watching her boyfriend and the camera watching everything. And immediately that idea of being watching and being watched is thrown right into that, into the story. And so that's a theme that runs through the whole thing. We see her.
And Zeus is watching.
Oh, Zeus. Right. Yeah. There you go. More Greek mythology. but we see her like covering up the camera on her computer with makeup.
Right.
Do
we want to throw up a spoiler flag just in case?
I think he did, didn't he?
No.
I thought you said we're going to talk spoilers and stuff.
I said before we talk about spoilers.
Oh, before we talk about spoilers and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of that stuff is general stuff. It's not really huge spoilers, but yeah.
I just try and be sensitive about that stuff.
Fair enough. All right, so we'll just throw it up, the spoiler. So if something slips out on mistake, it won't affect other people's viewing.
We were dancing on the edge there, so I just figured I'd say something.
Yeah, so that's fair. So folks who don't want to have anything spoiled, go see the film and come back and listen to us later. And so we'll talk about anything and everything. Eric, you were going to say something, my friend.
Well, I think I cut Mike off in the middle of a thought. Did you have more?
No. I was going to ask. I know I saw at least one reviewer, podcaster, whatever, offer a very bad defense of his hate for this film because he couldn't offer a good argument against the film. His argument against the film was that it was a well-made film, but he didn't like the politics of the film.
Okay.
And
that's an opinion.
It is an opinion, but he said the film is fucking horrible, which is a completely different thing.
Yeah, that's saying. Different.
And
well, because he said it's a good film, and then he says it's fucking horrible. That's contradictory. So,
well, he started by saying it's a fucking horrible film, and then it starts, and then as you got picked on, he basically admitted, yes, it's a good film, but I don't like the politics of it.
Right. So he doesn't like the message. He thinks there's a message in the film that he doesn't feel is
well. And here's the thing, and it's around this movie in particular. You cannot like a movie. And you can also dislike the politics of the movie. And those two things don't have to be related. Right. I saw somebody on another podcast group state that he thought this movie was fucking horrible and that it was working hard for woke circles, I believe are the words that were used. And this guy got torn to pieces, called a misogynist. And so on and so forth, just for saying that. And I was just reading all the comments, just going, whoa. The movie definitely has strong feminist themes. It has a lot to say about how women are treated, and you don't have to like that. But I don't think that not liking this movie automatically makes you misogynist.
No, I think
people go way too far, way too fast with their reactions on things like this these days.
Well, I would agree. And one of the things I did want to point out, because, you know, she is a female and, you know, one of the themes in this movie, I think, is equalization. and that is that, look, the narcissistic abuse and the situation she's in whenever we see a movie with a woman who's being victimized, particularly with narcissism, which really there hasn't been a whole lot done about, except for maybe Sleeping with the Enemy. Only we really didn't have a framework for what this illness, this fucked upness was called back then. The thing is that there are women who are abusive to men as well. Narcissism is not a gender-specific illness. I'm not even going to call it an illness. I'm just going to say it's crazy town. Sorry. They try to make it into like an illness and some kind of disorder. And really, it's just the people are damaged. It's like saying being a serial killer is an illness. I mean, these people are just – they're sick. And there is a theme of equalization in here, in that there is that one line where she says, I'm just a suburban girl who stumbled into your life one night. Why me? And it would not have been as effective, I think, to get the point across if they had reversed the roles. Mm-hmm. But that does not mean that there are not female narcissists. One of my very good friends divorced a female narcissist a year ago. Oh my God. Okay, maybe women don't go nuts and get violent and beat people up, but let me tell you, women can sometimes be very manipulative. Yes, they do sometimes. They can be very manipulative. They can be very bad. There was one friend of mine that she killed his cat.
Yikes.
She killed his cat, okay? And you know why she killed his cat? Because she said, well,
she's a sociopath.
Because she's a sociopath, and she basically told him that it was a whole gaslighting thing about how the cat is taking away my attention. You're supposed to be your focus in your life is terrible because you have ADD, and it's because you have this cat that you're not paying attention to me, and it's your fault that you're not paying attention to me, so I'm going to kill your cat.
Wow.
They think this is okay. Mm-hmm. They know it's wrong, but they do it anyway. So I think in what you guys were saying about feminism, yes, I think this has a very strong female perspective, but I do think there is a theme here in that this abuse can happen to any of us.
Well,
look at how the cop, when he comes in, gets beat up. I mean, he gets the shit beaten out of him. It's different.
You're right. You're right, Chrissy. However, I'll give you a particular example of why I was thinking of it more of being feminist. And it's the scene where she goes to the job interview, right? And she sits down with the dude, and he's asking her questions, and she talks about how she went to Paris. And this guy says, oh, is that where all the beautiful women go? And this dude, I don't think he meant anything by it. It was an innocent enough comment, but in the context of everything else that's going on in this movie, he says this to her, and you're just like, oh no.
Right. Right. That's a fair pointer. Yeah.
Right.
That popped out to me too. You know, again, if this was a different movie or with different themes, or if the guy met her at a bar and they were flirting with each other, no big deal. But at a job interview in a movie that has these type of themes, it stuck out like a sore thumb to me too. Yeah, absolutely.
Right. And that's why I was that's an example of the type of thing in this movie that I was thinking of when I referred to it as feminist, Chrissy.
Right. Well, and never mind. Okay.
And to be fair, that as a woman, that line stuck out to me too, and I thought it was really inappropriate and didn't belong in this movie. I was like, what the hell? What the hell does this have to do with anything?
Well,
we're gonna make a sexist comment now? Come on.
Right, but it was
dumb. It didn't belong there.
But here's the thing: I can pick out a couple of movies recently. Like there's a brief scene in Avengers Endgame. There's lines in Dark Phoenix that are just clearly put on to throw out to the stealing the line to throw out to the woke crowd. To the well, we should be called the X women and stuff like that. That's just clearly sort of obnoxious feminism.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of in your face, we're going to throw it out there and be in your face. But I think if we could somehow pretend the whole, like the Me Too movement didn't exist, if this film had come out 3 or 4 years ago instead of now, I don't think anybody would have that reaction to it.
Well, and like
Chrissy said, when Sleeping with the Enemy came out, nobody said, "Oh, this is an anti-male film."
Yeah, right?
And it's basically
that.
The same thing. It's the same thing, except the guy's not invisible.
Well,
you can go back to Silence of the Lambs, and a big thing is about Clarice being watched, and so the whole film watch. You know, you see how the male agents and others are looking at her and staring at her. To me, that scene in the interview, yeah, the guy is a little pervy, and he's but marginally pervy, because she's an attractive woman and he's a young guy. All right, and
that's what I'm saying. I don't think he was evil.
Right.
It was just in the context that it became that comment became a little creepy.
Right, and
want to agree with you, Mike.
Yeah.
I want to agree with you that most movies are a product of their time, and this one as well. And I was thinking to myself as I was thinking about this movie after I saw it and reading some reviews on it, I found myself wondering if this movie would have been reviewed as well had it not been released the same week that Harvey Weinstein was convicted.
And that's another reason thing, and that's something I admit I went in kind of skeptically, because sometimes there are films that have gotten good reviews because of what they say and not because of how they say it. And bad reviews for the same
agreed.
Reason.
What about Harley Quinn, right? That one came out, and so it's always in the news. Every film is even whether it's the product of your time or not, every film is going to be looked at through the eyes of the times, right? That's why if we look at older films, they feel dated or they feel politically incorrect or whatever. While you know during their time, no one batted an eye. So a film like Harley Quinn comes out, you're going to immediately look at it through the lens of the era, which is, like you said, the woke era, the Me Too era, whatever. And same with this film. And it's always been in the news, you know, like Harvey Weinstein, you just mentioned, Elizabeth Warren just quit the race for presidency. And one of the things she said in her quit, it was, you know, it's hard for a woman and sexism and all that. So it's always on topic, and it's very much in the news today, the woke stuff specifically related to gender and identity politics, that we're going to have to look at these films that way. And I think that's why these things popped out. Like you said, Eric, that a comment like that, we wouldn't even thought of, or it was you, Mike, 3 or 4 years ago, we wouldn't even think about it. But because of the time it is and the context of the film and what the film is showing us, a man abusing a woman or gaslighting a woman or being a narcissist or sociopath to a woman, any innocuous comment suddenly can look like a sexist comment, and technically it is a sexist comment. I mean, they just, Chris Matthews, right? He just got fired for these things. So it's all over the place.
Mm-hmm. Right. But I'm saying that I think what the concern is, people are afraid that they're going to go see the film, they're going to get lectured at.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I don't think that's the case. I think, look, if you know more than 5 women, there's a really good chance to talk to them. You know a woman who has had issues with someone like this, with having to deal with their own controlling narcissistic asshole. You almost guarantee it.
These
relationships exist in real life, and you have a really good, strong male figure in this film. He is not an asshole.
Yep.
So this is not a thing that's saying
true.
All women are better and men are terrible. You know, it's basically, you know, and the Elizabeth Moss character isn't necessarily a perfect character either. She's very,
it's hard to get
a gauge on her. It's because she's traumatized. But this is a story about one asshole who happens to be a male. This is not a thing of how wonderful women are and how terrible men are. It is not lecturing at the audience. And that is, I think, what annoys me is that, all right, you don't like the film, but I think people are trying too hard to put that preachiness into it, and it really isn't there.
No, I didn't find it preachy.
Yeah, and that's kind of why I guess I didn't consider it like a go woman movie, because I was coming at it from, this is all about someone trying to escape and move on to a better life from the trauma of narcissistic abuse. And to me, it was really more about that struggle, because I have been there. I know a lot of people who have been there. As there,
well. There it is. We know five women, and there's the woman right there, Chris.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah, but I mean, my point is just that I think it really had more to say about, like, one of the big themes in here was, like I said, reinventing. Okay, Elizabeth Moss eventually finds her strength, which had been practically beaten out of her, which is what these assholes do. They totally convince you that you're a piece of shit, that you're not worth anything, that you are nothing without them, that you can't live without them, because there's like, they have this way of charming you and making you think they're perfect. They also throw out the charm for everyone else, and then they go home and they berate you. It's very much, this is a really insidious type of individual, a behavioral health individual, Phil. This is really, I mean, Ted Bundy was probably one of these people.
Yeah, he was a sociopath, dissocial personality disorders.
Yeah.
Chrissy, you're not wrong about anything you just said.
I don't know what you're talking about, Chrissy. I think you're crazy. I think you need to see help. Get some help.
You know what?
Mike's gaslighting us.
You bastard.
He's gaslighting.
Here's the thing. I don't think anybody has to be wrong in this discussion, because everything you just said is correct, Chrissy. But in my viewing the movie as feminist, this female character is the one who went through this traumatic experience and fought back and survived. And to me, in that manner, it's feminist.
Interesting though is that she never goes that route. In other words, you could, depending on your definition of feminism, you can say this is a feminist film or whatever. But it's her story, and she's apolitical, and that's what I like about the film, is that she's not political. So she's not like saying this is terrible. It's not that, you know. She says it's just this one guy. He's the SOB, maybe the brother too, as we find out, and that's it. She's not saying all men, she's not saying men suck, she's not saying this, that, you know, she's wrong because all people suck, but besides that, she's not saying based off of your gender you're a piece of garbage. Yes. What she's saying is that it's just this one person who's done this horrible thing to me. So people have to look at it that way too. You can't just look at it and say it's all men, because she's not even saying that.
Right. And it's also not, which I found with, say, some other films, go back to Aliens. All right, showed a strong, an alien, strong female character. And in that regard, Vasquez too. And in that regard, if you want to say, you know, feminist film, fine. But at no point did Ripley like turn to the camera and go, "I don't need no man," or "Women, girl power, get into." If they'd gone there, I understand it's kind of like, oh, God, that's... And even Terminator 2, right? Terminator 2 has a moment where Sarah Connor goes there talking about the power of women versus men. But then they cut away and everyone's staring at her like, you've gone off your fucking rocker, right? So it sort of makes fun of that, right? So it's not... It's that, again, is it portraying strong women, or is it lecturing to the audience that women are strong?
Right.
And I also think, is there a wagging finger of doom? And there isn't.
And perhaps this is partially on me for using the word feminist. There's some terminology that's become loaded, and that's a word that's loaded. People tend to hear that word, and depending on your view of things, either think it's an extremely positive word or an extremely negative word. Just like the word ignorant has connotations. All it means is that you don't know something. I'm ignorant about rocket science. I don't know anything about it. You're obtuse. But people think of ignorant as being an insult when it's really just describing a lack of knowledge. In terms like social justice warrior. In general, I think social justice is a good thing. What's wrong with being a warrior for it? But it's come to be a pejorative that means a certain type of person that goes overboard. Terminology has become loaded.
Yeah. Right, and I've said for years that the word feminism is kind of lost its meaning.
right? It's become weaponized.
Become weaponized, but it's kind of lost its meaning because at the basic level, you can say, are you a feminist? In which case it means you have this weird radical concept that women are people too. That's basic feminism. But if you get into it, there's first wave feminism, second wave feminism, third wave feminism, fourth wave feminism, new wave feminism, punk rock feminism, whatever. There's all sorts of variety of feminism. And they all say
there's feminine feminism.
And they all say somewhat different things, or it's progressed to mean different things. And it also then every individual brings their own particular take and spin on it. And so what does it mean? It really just depends on who you talk to, which means it doesn't really mean anything anymore because it means a different thing to almost everybody, unless you happen to specialize in the particular classes and your professors have said this is what feminism means and you've taken it to heart to mean exactly what it means there. So I think all of us are on the same page in that women are probably people too. Right?
I don't know, we can ask Chrissy. Chrissy, are you a people?
The last time I checked, I was still a person. But
and they can be good people and they can be terrible. Like I know that there was talking about a character on a TV show that was a villain and was a woman, and like they were like shocked that a woman could be as evil as a man. I'm like,
oh boy.
Really? Are you fucking kidding me?
Really?
they can be more evil. They're just better getting away with it.
Oh my God. I mean, and look,
Helen Ozark.
And I'm well aware, like, and I just had this conversation today with someone at work where he just transferred into our school from the middle school. But when he was down in the middle school, they had someone come in and talk to the kids about abusive relationships. And she's talking to the kids and giving them examples of abusive relationships. And every example he used was a man being abusive towards a woman. Now, this is a guy that my colleague who had been in an abusive relationship. And he spoke to her afterwards and pointed this out to her, you know, that you need to tell these kids that abusive relationships can go the other way. It's not all one way. Mm-hmm. And I'm well aware, and he's well aware, that it is overwhelming majority of abusive relationships, the man is the abuser. I don't deny that, especially if you're talking physical abuse. That's
physical.
Yes.
But there's more than enough women, way too many women and way too many men that are also abusive, as you mentioned, can be physically, especially to kids, psychologically and emotionally abusive. There's lots of ways, and it's bad. Yes, the numbers are more heavily weighted one side to the other. This film does not say all men are abusive, right? And
no,
we've seen
not.
Films like that where every man in the film is bad man.
Well, and no, here's
go ahead, Chris.
Oh, go ahead. Well, no, go ahead, Eric.
I was just going to say, I also think the whole gaslighting aspect of this, the movie is fascinating. I didn't know it for a while, but I had a friend who would gaslight his girlfriends. It took me a while to pick up on it, but he would do things, and particularly after he broke up with somebody, he would purposely say things that if you wrote down the words, they don't seem bad, but he would purposely state things at a time in a manner to trigger a reaction from them and then be like, well, she's fucking crazy.
All I said
was this. She's fucking psycho.
This is the issue with gaslighting, because it depends on what it really means, right? Because this, based off of the original film and what I understand gaslighting is, this really isn't gaslighting, because what this is doing is making her look crazy to other people rather than making herself feel like she's going crazy.
You don't think there was any of that in this movie?
No. Well, obviously, once she knows he's there.
That's like halfway through the movie.
Right, but that entire time, that's when all the quote unquote gaslighting type of things begin to be obvious. And yet they're not applied as true gaslighting, because it's the other people saying you're crazy rather than she saying,
well, it's
am I going crazy?
It's two different things, actually. in the narcissist world, okay, there is gaslighting, which is what you do to your victim, okay, your general second person. I'm not a narcissist, although I do have a comment about how when a lot of times if you need to escape a narcissist or if you need to get away from a narcissist and keep them away from you, the victim will sometimes, and I have resorted to this, almost become as bad as the narc, which is sort of what happens here at the end of this movie, to be able to defeat that person. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You almost have to hand them their ass. Fight fire with fire.
Like,
exactly. And that's very damaging too, because then your concept of who you are as a good person, you really feel guilty about it. But there's gaslighting. Then there is what's called besmirching. And what besmirching is when, for example,
that's a fantastic word. That was one of the, my freshman year in high school, that was one of our 10-cent vocabulary words.
Yep. And besmirching is, and it is a thing in narcissism. It's like, okay, so I would send a letter to my boyfriend's mother, right? And say, I left whatever the hell his name is, Jack or whatever. I left Jack. I'm very sad about this. But, you know, I love spending time with your family and you were a lovely person. Thank you for making me feel welcome. Okay. Then the mother gets Jack's side of the story. And Jack will turn around and go, well, you know, she's a crazy asshole. I dumped her. And, you know, she's going to stalk you now because she sent you a note. That's called besmirching. So I think what your friend was doing, Eric, was not necessarily gaslighting them, but besmirching that. In other words, he was so that they would appear crazy to other people, like Phil said. But it is actually two different things. Like if you read the books, it is two completely different things. So anyway, now
here's my one issue with this movie, and I'm just going to get it out of the way now, is that I had a little bit of a problem believing that this guy was so dedicated to tormenting this woman that he would fake his own death. and then later set it up so it looked like he had been taken captive by his brother? What?
Oh,
none of that made much sense to me. I was just like, what?
It made sense to me though, only because I have dealt with narcs that are crazy, never that crazy, but I know that there are
pretty batshit crazy.
There are some people that really are though, because I had one. There was one girl in my office, in fact, and her this guy that she was like cheating on her husband with. Okay, but this guy literally was a narc, and oh my god, the stuff that he was doing to try to harm her and manipulate her was insane. I mean, it really was. So that part of this plot did not bother me, only because I was like, you know what, I could actually see if somebody was really that insane, I could see it.
Well, and the fact because that his brother was in on it most of the time.
But he said, here's the thing, when you're a lot of times where these narcissists come from is that they're born with a tendency for it. And again, I'm not a psychological expert, and please, I'm no expert. This is just all from what I've read and what I've observed. But a lot of them come from homes where there was a narcissist already. So like their mom was a narcissist, the father was a narcissist, or God forbid you had two of them. And so when the brother, the first thing that gave me a clue that it was probably the brother that did it was when he was getting all earnest with her and he was like, oh, or he's like, you know, I hated him too. He tried to control me too. And I almost bought it, except that it was so slick. And this is why I say this script is well done. It was so slick. I was like, oh my God, dude, no, he's one of them. He's one too. And what that led me to believe was that the two of them probably grew up in a home where there was one, if not more than one, like both parents were narcs. And that was how they learned to survive, was by being narcs themselves. And so that didn't seem batshit crazy to me. Plus, obviously, both the brothers are successful. They both have obviously make a lot of money. I was wondering if maybe there was family money. So you know what? They didn't even really have to work or anything. They just kind of did whatever. And that can also be a breeding ground. But usually what breeds narcs is they come from a narcissistic environment. There's at least one narc in the history. There is research to suggest that there may be a genetic component to it as well, but I can't that nobody's proven that, so I don't know.
But here's the thing. What does it really make it better that he faked his own death? I mean, really, couldn't he just like still be like whatever, he's back in his mansion and whatever, and all this spooky shit's happening with the invisible man and she still can't prove it's him? I mean,
well, if he's if he's legally dead, it becomes
theoretically becomes, being dead makes it that much better.
Well, because if she's dead, she lets her guard down, I'm guessing. And look, in the end, one thing I've learned is that there do be crazy people, and I don't think a sane human being, or even only marginally sane human beings, can really fathom how fucked up human beings can get when they go crazy.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and I would like to actually
That was the only issue I had with this movie.
I would kind of like to shift gears just for one second. Before I forget, I kind of wanted to talk about there's a really strong motif in here with water.
Mm-hmm.
But in particular, it's like furiously moving water. Yeah. Water is directly associated with the emotions. And it does not only add an atmosphere to the film, it says something about the types of emotions that Cecilia and even these other characters are experiencing. I mean, right, we don't see nice calm lakes and trickling streams to indicate happiness and calm. And we don't see misty, damp afternoons or a light drizzle like we would in a ghost story, which can indicate melancholy and dread. The opening shot of this film, like you said, Eric, is that pounding water and of the ocean on the rocks. And like I said, if you see this in the Dolby Theater, it really is going to rock your innards. It's crazy loud.
I did.
Yeah. It was really... that was when I was like, oh my God, I don't know if I can do this. My insides are vibrating. but it was good.
I mean, it
was cool. Once I got used to it, I was fine. But it suggests, though, in that opening image is that there's a lot of intensity in this relationship between them. And that Cecilia, once we understand what her circumstances, she's experiencing heightened emotions. And clearly, this is a woman in crisis. And then in addition, later on in the film, we see a lot of rain, and it's furious rain. It's always pounding rain. It's never like, you know, a drizzle. And that suggests that there's a torrent of emotions that are the catalyst for her wanting to get rid of this toxicity in her life, because the rain intensifies toward the end of the film. And as we know, water and rain also represent like cleansing, right? When it rains, it washes everything away.
Also so change.
Yeah. And change. Yeah, totally. And I think the only place we see the weather as being just plain old damp is in the few quiet moments in the film, like just before she senses that he's around. Mm-hmm. Just before she feels like she's being watched. That's the only part of the movie where she thinks that she's completely safe. And so, therefore, her emotions are calm. But the rest of the time, her emotions are all like up in the air. And I just really wanted to get that out before I forgot to say it, because okay, I really found that that was so useful. I read recently, I was reading an essay on writing good fiction recently. It was probably last week. And they were like, look at your weather and what it's doing. So, of course, when I saw the water and the rain, I was like, oh, yeah, because this is all fresh in my head. Mm. And I don't really know if that was done intentionally
There was
for
so
the
much of it, I'd be
that
surprised
I said,
if it wasn't.
Yeah, I mean, it really was. And, oh, can I ask you guys, what did you think about that moment in the Uber where he's doing that, like, 10-point turn, like, that the guy mentioned in the article? Because I really was shitting my pants at that. I don't know if you guys were.
Oh, yeah. Well, there was a lot of moments like that, like when the pan is set on fire and the smoke, and you figure either we're going to see the Invisible Man through the smoke from the fire, or he's going to be behind them because, you know, it was a wide lens, as Mike mentioned. And so there was a lot of these red herrings that are cliches that would usually be, oh, you would see the Invisible Man in the smoke, or the Invisible Man would make it to the car during the Uber turn. But Wanell is smart enough to take what we expect because of so many movies we've seen and then change it up where the things that don't happen or should happen don't happen, and the suspense, like, is as bad as the coronavirus with me in the movie theater.
Right. You're not gonna let that go, are you? Well, I gotta say, one of the things I loved about this movie was the fight scenes. The concept of fighting an invisible person is fucking terrifying, and the way they depicted that on the screen was awesome.
And Eric, that's how they did the special effects, is how you mentioned with the car, right? Where you don't see the you know, they, when you back up and you have a trailer, it disappears the trailer for you, so you can see what you're supposed to see. That's probably how they did this too, where because Elizabeth Moss is getting pulled around in the kitchen,
right,
in the family room, and you don't see.
Well, and she's smashing plates over something that's not there. I was like, holy shit, how did they even do that?
Yeah,
well, I mean the easy thing, my guess, because now you know, since at least Star Wars, you have the computers can just recreate the camera movements.
Mm-hmm.
You just have the camera movement with him in a green suit, you know,
right.
And then go back and just CGI him out, and then fill in. And I mean, one of the things that is a problem with old invisibility effects, which again for the time were awesome. But if you know what you're looking for, like you see when he takes his pants off, you can't see the other side of the pants. You know, it's, you know, because it's blocked by the blue screen suit or whatever it is they used to cover it.
It was black velvet, actually, I read.
Oh, black velvet, right. Okay. And here you could just go back in and put the other side of the pants in with CGI. Mm-hmm. But like the scene with the paint. Right.
Dude,
that was
probably. That's the best jump scare I've seen in a long
time. Oh my god, that was
time.
Awesome. That was
I
awesome.
Nearly shit myself.
And having the suit, and so you get that
yeah,
that
weird bump thing,
pattern.
Yeah.
And man, and you're one of those people has an issue with holes, that suit is gonna give you a fucking nightmare.
Right.
right.
Yeah, I mean, it's so good. And I was thinking,
and that's the first time his existence is actually proven, right?
Right. And, yeah. And that's something else. This is another article we can link to it. That I share where they talk about Wanell and the beginning of the film, right? Which it starts with them in bed together and we watch her get away.
Right.
And now, look, we all know we went to see a movie called The Invisible Man. So the one thing we are expecting to see in this movie is an invisible man.
It's not that.
Right.
The case,
right. Yeah. Or we're expecting to not. We're the one thing expecting to be in the film is an invisible man.
Right.
So
right.
We know what movie we saw. Just like, you know, when it's these movies where, like, oh, my God, how did these people die with two holes in their neck and drained of all the blood in their body? And the whole audience is, you know, vampire, dumbass. But he got feedback from the studio saying, can't we just show of him being mean to her or punching her or something? And he said no, and he trusted the audience. But I think another reason why that – I think it works great that way, and everything is sold in the performance and the direction. You get it. I don't think it's a problem. And then you do get to see him being a fucking lunatic when he punches his hand through the window.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But even then, I think it works because if for some reason you don't know what movie you're watching, I don't know why you wouldn't. You flip it on channel 5 in the afternoon.
You would know why she's leaving.
Well, and
you could be going, is this chick crazy or is he really an asshole? So, you know, so I don't think it's necessary, but I'm so glad that they didn't and they went with the opening that they did. But again, it does offer that little sliver of a window for the audience to question her sanity until, of course, the paint scene. When we know, like, even with the kitchen, right? If this was in James Whale's version, you would have seen a close up of the stove and the knob being turned by the invisible hand, and you would have seen the flame, and it was a close up of the flame going up higher, and then you would have pulled back again and seen the smoke, and because they needed to emphasize to the audience. When, again, film also being a new medium and they were still learning how to communicate with it, but it would have spelled everything out. Here, I mean, did you see a noticeable difference in the flame?
But, Mike,
I did, actually, Mike.
But not a big one.
But I noticed it.
All right.
So, therefore, it was noticeable.
All that we saw in the 1933 version was brand new to cinema. So,
that was what you did at the time.
Right. Now everybody copies what that movie did. So Wan-El, he's trying to not copy what happened in other films.
And he's very much trying to do the Omen beheading trick, right? Where get the audience to jump at an unexpected spot, you know, and you guys all know the story, right? With the Omen and the beheading.
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah.
Where he says, you know, the audience is going to look away on the 3 count, so cut the head off at the 4 count when they look back. And so he's doing things like that where he's saying, expect someone here, expect something there, and have something happen at the times that are unexpected. There's a scene in the, I don't know if it's the trailer or commercial, and some of the stills of Elizabeth Moss in a shower with the handprint on the shower glass.
Yeah, that's not in the movie.
That's not in the movie because that's obvious, but he wants to avoid doing that. And so he does, and so he gets a lot of mileage out of it by going in an unexpected direction.
Well, and I think too, I agree with you with that opening as being genius because I also read that article. And it's almost like we come in on medias res, but everybody does, the acting is so good that he achieved his goal, which is he said, I wanted the audience to understand how terrifying her life was just by the way she reacted. Like when she kicks the dog bowl and she almost has a fucking heart attack right there. You're like, oh my God, this guy is going to kill her. If he catches her, this guy is a monster. And I think
we've all been there though, right? We've all, not necessarily with a monster in the house, but where we've all been trying to walk quietly in the house. And then we step on the cat. Don't look at me like that. The cat sitting here staring at me when I said that. I apologize. It was intentional.
Hit the child's toy or whatever. Yeah.
Right. Step on the squeaky toy. Right.
One of my favorite moments in the movie was when she is convinced that after the daughter gets hit. And the dad takes off with the daughter, which I thought was an amazingly effective moment in the movie.
Yes.
When she's in the room with the daughter and Invisible Dick fucking slaps this little girl as hard as he can. And it happens so fast that even the girl thinks that Elizabeth Moss did it. And so the dad takes her and tells Elizabeth Moss to get the fuck out. And like after that happens, she knows that he's around, so she like takes a bag of coffee and dumps it on the floor. She's like trying to pull the Paranormal Activity trick so she can see the footprints. And then she's sitting across from the doorway, and there's this great scene where she's talking to the doorway, and is he there? I don't know. He might be. You can't fucking see him. She just delivers this monologue to the doorway for like 2 minutes. I'm like, holy shit. How do you do that if you're Elizabeth Moss?
That, That was the monologue that you brought up, Chrissy, about I just happened to come into your life like me.
Yep.
Yeah. And it was that scene, yeah.
I will tell you.
And it doesn't pay off either, the coffee, right? I mean, again, that's something that we're expecting, and he purposely doesn't pay it off. Now, Chrissy, you going to say something?
Yeah, another thing that I wanted to talk about that I really loved in this movie was, like Mike said, the empty space is almost like It Follows, where you're expecting to see something. But I think what I loved was the specific creepy moments too. The ones that weren't jump scares, they were just really creepy. Like the blanket underneath the guy's feet. And yes. I was terrified. I was like, oh my God, oh my God. And of course, you know, it's the Invisible Man. You know, you're not going to see it. But she goes to pull the blanket and it's stuck under something.
Mm-hmm.
And there was just something really scary about that. I think that really appeals to our primal fears.
That was also just great directing and script writing, because just before that, she had been staring at the chair going, oh, I think he's sitting in the chair.
Oh, yeah, because the chair creaks.
So she throws the blanket over the chair, and there's nothing, there's nobody in the chair. So then she picks the blanket up and goes to walk away, and he's stepping on it. So it's like a delayed scare, and it hits you that much harder. It's brilliant.
I know. It was really well done. And I love also the sister. The dynamic between her and her sister was really interesting, too.
Oh, my God. The scene in the restaurant.
Oh my God. I screamed, holy shit, I think. I went, oh, holy shit. Like, I was not expecting that.
Well, this is where we know.
The thing with that was,
it's very important, that scene, because prior to that, he was just an abuser and a psycho. At that moment, we now know that he's a murderer.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was when the film really swung into gear, because now he's willing to kill people, you know. And so I thought that was an important moment just for that fact, because prior to that, he was just a stalker.
Well, and now that I'm thinking about it, man, I watched so many horror movies that I generally don't jump a whole lot anymore. But this movie got me twice with paint scene and with the restaurant scene. That happened in the restaurant. I was just like, what the fuck? Holy shit.
And Eric, throw the smack in the girl scene in there too.
Oh, yeah.
And because I think part of it is that we know what's going on. He's gaslighting her. He's going to fuck with her when nobody's around and drive her crazy. Mm-hmm. So when she's with somebody, we think he's not there or that she's safe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? We're not expecting, and we're expecting subtle shit. He's going to move things around. He's going to turn the burner on. And he just hauls off and wails on this girl out of nowhere. And and of course, we can't see him, so we don't see the wind up to brace ourselves for it. Just out of nowhere,
right.
Wham! And then same thing in the restaurant. By the time our brain realized, it takes like your brain a second because it happens so fast.
Right. Yeah,
you're looking and going, knife. And by the time you're thinking, oh shit, the knife, throat's cut.
All right. And, well, and even after that, there's like a 2 second beat. One, two, and so you're just watching like, what the hell just happened? And then the blood starts coming out. It's like, holy shit, and everybody starts screaming in the restaurant.
Well, and the breakdown she has at that point is fucking amazing. Like when she just like collapses on the floor.
Yeah.
That was amazing. Yeah. And Elizabeth Moss is so great in this movie. Another one of my favorite moments in this movie is when they're trying to restrain her in the mental institution, and she's just fighting with everything, and she just screams, "You motherfucker!"
Yeah,
Eric, yes. Eric, it's a behavioral health building.
No, you should get over it.
You know what else I really liked, guys? I really liked that touch with when she manages to damage the suit. And the cameras on the suit make that whirring sound, and it almost makes him sound like a monster, like a serpent of some kind. Did you guys pick up on that? I really liked it.
No, I honestly didn't.
Oh, my God. Well, maybe it was because my Dolby was rocking my innards, and I could feel that twisting right in my stomach. But,
or maybe you were just hearing things.
Oh, maybe I was.
She's being gaslit by the movie.
I know.
Besmirched.
But I love it. Well, okay, so she damages the suit by stabbing him with whatever that was, the quill pen that she took out of the brother's bag. And she damages the suit enough so that, you know, we can see, like, the cameras, that it's actually he's a guy in a black suit. When those cameras are damaged, and we did hear the whirring sound when we first discovered the suit, they make like a turning noise because they're broken. So he is no longer silent when he moves. So if you guys watch this movie again, listen for that sound effect. It's there. It's pretty throughout whenever he's moving. After the suit is damaged, it really sounds like a snake, like a creepy, like serpentine monster. It was really well done. I really liked it. I thought the sound was just chilling, and I loved the parallel there. Like basically by, okay, yes, she's defeating him, but we are now seeing that he really is a monster, that he is real. And sort of symbolically, it kind of reinforces that. And so that was something else I thought that was really genius, but I'm surprised you guys didn't notice it. I know it was there.
It sounds like the volume was extreme in your theater.
I went to Dolby Theater,
but the volume wasn't like bone shaking. It was just it's the one theater in the nice theater I like to go to that's set up with Dolby Atmos. So it's got all the surround stuff, which is super cool, but it's not overly loud.
Well, yeah, when I got to my car, my butt was still vibrating. Just saying. Seriously.
In the other theater I go to in the area, they have an actual IMAX certified theater, and I went to go watch a movie there. It was the first showing of the day, and it was in the IMAX theater. And they told me when I bought my ticket, you're going to have to wait for 10 minutes before you go in. I was like, oh, well, and I was a little early, but I was like, well, why? Why can't I just sit down? And she goes, oh, well, they're running all the sound tests on the system right now, and if you go in there, you'll damage your hearing. I was like, all right, then, I'll stay out here.
Yeah, Chrissy, we have our theater has a very special, it's like a really neat, unique sound system where you can hear like all the noises from the theaters on either side of you. So it's like you can hear three films at once, so you get that extra value. So they sell advertising, you get three movies for the price of one. So it's really nice. Actually, for this movie, that wasn't so bad because they do have thin walls. This used to be a supermarket that kind of converted, so it's not the best theater ever. But it is 5 minutes away, you know, so that's the benefit to it. It's either this or drive 30 minutes to the AMC, and you know, my wife tends to prefer to stay local.
You were talking earlier about how they get you to stay engaged in this movie when it's very, very quiet. I was having a blast during this movie because there are lots of scenes during the first half of the movie where Elizabeth Moss will be standing alone, well, from what you can see, in a room just looking around, right? And every time they had like just a shot on her face, her face is like center frame. I was always looking behind her. I was like looking to see a door open, looking to see some curtains move, looking to see something, and it was never fucking there.
I know. It was like
my head.
It was like Mike said, it was that it follows thing where you're like sitting there going, oh my God, is there something moving in the distance? What's going on there? And you freak yourself out because you want to see something and it's not really there. And also, you know why I think that was also effective too? How many of us, and I'm sure all the listeners and you guys could agree with me, have been home alone in your house? You know, okay, whether you believe in ghosts or not, you know your house is not haunted. You know there's no one home. And suddenly you feel like there's someone in the room with you, or suddenly you feel like you're being watched. And I don't know if you guys have felt that, but I felt, I know other people have felt it. And so in that first scene,
I look over and there's a cat sitting there.
Yeah, exactly. But my point is just that I think we can sense when there are other humans around us, even if we can't really see them, because I think humans throw off electrical, you know, what are we, like 80% water or something, Mike?
It depends.
Are we like
on what
electrics
part of the body
and water
about.
Or whatever? Yeah.
Yeah, so there's a very large percentage of us that's water.
Yeah. So I think we can sense each other. And so I think that moment where she's hanging up her new clothes and she turns around as though she thinks someone's there.
Mm-hmm.
And like, oh my God, that camera spends forever. I'm like, oh my God, oh my God. Like,
I kept on
just,
watching the
clothes
on the rack. I kept on looking for something and nothing. I'm like, God, God.
Yeah. And it's agonizing. It's just so well done. But I think we can all identify with that because that's the moment where she goes, oh, I guess there's no one here, just like we all do. But
60%
then later.
Water. I just looked it up.
60? Wow.
Yeah,
I thought
60% of
that.
The human adult body is water.
Yeah,
right.
I gotta drink more alcohol. I don't like
but
that.
But Mike's right. Certain parts of the body are even, you know, more versus less. So the brain.
Some of your cells can be up to 90% water, and it just depends on
the brain.
There's a lot of water in my jiggly belly.
The brain and heart are 73%. Lungs are 83%. Skin is 64%. Kidneys 79%, and even the bones are watery, 31%. So there you go. It's an amazing tool called the internet.
No, I've never heard of that. Phil, I don't think that exists. I think you made that up.
We're just talking through tubes right now.
The thing is, as I said, it was an amazing tool, but based off of social media, it's not too amazing.
Well, that's just a tool being used for the wrong purpose.
Right. Good point.
That's like using a hammer to kill somebody. Doesn't mean it's a bad tool.
That's true. Yes. Now, let me ask you this. Mike, you brought it up. Well, I brought it up, but then you brought up the analogy. The dog named Zeus. What do you think?
Really weird amount of dog.
It's a good dog.
Because the dog shows up 3 times, I think.
Yes, 3. At the beginning, the middle, and then the end.
And it's funny because I'm thinking as I'm watching the movie, I'm like, you know, I think I'm going to have to point out in the podcast that the one problem is they never resolve what the fuck happened to the dog.
Right, I found it.
Right, well, and
it runs away at the end.
Yeah, it does, but like
it runs ahead of Elizabeth's moth as she's leaving.
Right. I was saying right before she saw the dog again. You know, I was just thinking that we never did learn out. I'm like wondering whatever happened to the dog. He died. Right. First of all, she lets the dog out, and then it turns and you're in a wall compound. So, well, that doesn't help. Right. She didn't help the dog at all because it's going to be real easy for him to find the freaking thing. You know, she climbed over a fence. She didn't open. So, and your thing, I'm like wondering, I'm waiting because it's a freaking horror film to find out he murdered the dog. And,
He likes dogs.
And nobody had a shock collar on the dog.
Well, I don't know if it was a shock. I thought it was more of one of those electric fence collars.
Yeah, that's big impression.
Well, whatever. Okay, so, regardless, you don't know what is going to happen with the dog. And then she sees the dog and then leaves the dog again and then comes back. So, yeah, it's just weird how the dog was there but wasn't, like, a weird amount of story for the dog. I think it could have been more or less, but it was just weird. But it was a nice dog. He was fine. He was an actual legitimately sized dog.
Well, I can explain the center part of the story, because it's like, yeah, how did the dog survive if he suicided and all that? Again,
he's been feeding the dog.
The story is not about the dog, Phil,
right,
to be clear.
Right. And he never died, so it didn't even matter. Right. But the name, Zeus, you said it meant something, Mike.
Well, Zeus is the king of the gods and the husband of Hera and Argus
and
of 100
a
eyes.
Lot
was
of
the
half-humans.
Yeah, oh yeah. And Zeus was weird. It's like, Zeus never like said, hey, I'm going to turn myself into a sexy man and you can have sex with. No. Hi, I'm in the form of a bull and I want to screw you, you know. Hi, I'm a swan. It's like, hi, I'm coming down to you as a beam of light. It's like, what the fuck? Can you just human penis and testicles? Is it really that bad? I mean, oh, God.
All right. I think we may have finished talking about the movie.
All right.
Chrissy, you said you had some article you wanted to talk about.
Oh, no. I think we kind of were touching on it. We were just talking about the guy who said that that this was really like an I think the only point that I agreed with him was where he said they shouldn't have called it The Invisible Man because it's got nothing to do with the original and it's not really an update. Well, yeah, I could have told you that. Like, but there's nothing wrong. I mean, there can be two movies called The Invisible Man at different points in time. Right. I just think what they did with it was fine. I wouldn't consider it an update. I would consider it a really interesting use of the concept.
Here's the thing. I'm going to give credit to Dave Z over on the Exploding Heads Horror Movie Podcast, because he has a saying he likes to use, which is, if you're going to remake it, remake it.
Yeah.
There's no point in like doing the same story the exact same way again. If you're going to do something with an idea, make it a little different. And that's certainly what they did here. And I think it was very well done in that regard.
Yeah, I would agree. You know, and I think the only other point that I really wanted to make was that also I loved those scenes where she was getting violently beat up by him, but you couldn't see it.
Right.
Because to me, the Invisible Man is really a stand-in for those things that haunt us, like metaphorically. And so in a way, there's a level of this movie that is also a ghost story. You know, it's kind of about, you know, she is haunted. Even let's say he wasn't real, right? She's haunted by the traumatic things that happened to her. She's haunted by the grief and the pain and the loss and the trauma. And I think as a statement for this movie, it's talking about how those things can come back from our past, those egregious things, those awful things that we've suffered, and beat us up at any time.
And just because other people can't see them doesn't mean they're not there.
That's correct. And I think we must also, and that is a big theme now, you know, talk about your feelings, talk about what's going on inside you that people can't see. And we also must be ready to fight and do battle. And, you know, and I think that is one of the messages of this movie, is that no matter who you are, if you are getting beat up by invisible things, you must keep fighting, because she never gives up. Even when she's, you know, I mean, she really, that's the other thing I want to talk about. I think the conflict building in this was really well done, because every time you turned around, she was just getting into deeper, deeper shit. And you were just like, oh, my God, how are you going to get out of this one? You know, and she always would.
Well, and this guy was such a dick. And one of the things I found interesting in comparing this to the 1933 movie was that in 1933 movie, this scientist makes a solution to turn himself invisible, and the side effect of that is that he starts to become I don't know if evil's the right word, but certainly, like I said earlier, delusions of grandeur, thinking that he's going to rule the world, and have an army
of invisible men will rule the world.
And this guy, he's an evil asshole, who invents a way to be invisible so he can make people do what he wants. I just thought that was an interesting juxtaposition.
Or he just, you know, realizes that after he finishes gaslighting Elizabeth Moss, he could then, you know, whatever legal trouble he might potentially get into, he would just say, can I have the number of the Defense Department? I have something they might be interested in.
Right.
And this will bring me back to the article. I think you guys are reading a little bit too much hostility in the articles. The article basically says this is a good movie. It is a successful film, but it fails as a reboot because it's completely different from the original. And it using that to remind people to go read the book and see the original story, Invisible Man story, because it says something different than does this one. And if you're looking for that, then you're gonna you might be disappointed because you're not gonna get what you're looking for. And it talks a lot about sort of the need and the importance of existing IPs, because that's how you get your funding. Because now you remember early 2000s, late 90s movie with Kevin Spacey's invisible penis called The Hollow Man.
You mean Kevin Bacon?
Kevin Bacon's right, invisible penis, wrong one. Yes, Kevin Bacon's invisible bacon. The Hollow Man, right?
The existence of that movie. I did go see it in the theaters. I remember very little about it.
Right, and I just remember Kevin Bacon's bacon.
It's pretty good. It's pretty good, even though a dog gets killed.
Right. It is an Invisible Man story that doesn't have an Invisible Man. Doesn't have the title The Invisible Man. They could just as easily have done the same thing here. So the point of the article is they have that on here because it's a marketing tool. You know, it fails as a remake or reboot or reimagining, in that it doesn't take what was there before and either expand on it or explore those ideas further. It just does something completely different. And it's just pointing out that it's different. And I don't think that's a bad idea in terms of just tossing around what's the
difference.
No, I don't
think it's different. I don't think it's better to be different. I prefer it to be different. It's more interesting.
Well, he's saying... Well, but again, I think it's a perfectly fine thing for an argument and for a discussion and debate. I don't think he's saying, oh, this film sucks because it's saying it's not good as a remake, but it is a very good film in and of itself. And that's a large part of the article.
I guess the problem with that article, and I didn't like the article, was I think he doesn't get the point. The point is that they took the name and idea and then made a completely different thing. That's true. But the point was is that they didn't care about the themes of the book or the movie, the original movie, where, you know, alienation and all that stuff. It was adapted for today. So he has a point. It's valid in a sense, but I don't think it's necessary.
Well, no. Well, he makes the comment at the beginning of the first paragraph in the article, talking about the Lawnmower Man and saying how Stephen King sued those people who made the Lawnmower Man because it had very little to do with the story he wrote. And he's basically saying there are many remakes or adaptations that are original ideas that just slapped the name on there for marketing purposes. And that's basically what he's saying is, and that's what the article is sort of discussing.
He says
one of the best examples is The Thing, which, you know, are two different versions of the same story, and they're recognizably the same story, but they're from two different points of view, from two different eras, and obviously different technologies make things possible at the time. And this doesn't explore the same ideas in the same way, so it just really takes the title and slaps it on something original. And he's not saying it's in his view of what a remake or reboot should be. It doesn't work as a remake or reboot, but it works as its own thing.
It's a completely distinct thing. Absolutely. Well, and I heard somewhere, or I read somewhere, that they didn't even give a credit to H.G. Wells in the film credits. And that may be true. I don't know. But, because it's so unlike that book, never mind the original film. So, yeah, it's a completely distinct thing, and it's really just using the title, as you said.
Well, yeah, and I think it's fine. Because, they could theoretically come out with a movie called Spider-Man that's about a scientist that turns himself into a spider.
Right.
Right. Eric sums it up perfectly. Yeah, that's right. I mean, obviously, Spider-Man is probably a trademark name, so they probably couldn't technically because of that, but your point is absolutely 100% right, Eric.
Well, and that's kind of why I was saying there's, you know, you can have movies that have similar names, and I understand that IP, like, for example, if we made a movie called Jurassic Park, everybody would expect that it's going to be connected to the original Jurassic Park IP. But what if it wasn't? What if I decided to make a movie or write a novel called Jurassic Park, and it had nothing to do with dinosaurs, and it was about this park in the middle of this island where these people went and sat around and, I don't know, dropped acid or smoked crack all day.
Right.
You know, I mean, I could do that. Like, you know.
Well, and they have. There's been a lot of these B-movies that are called Jurassic Carnival or Jurassic's
Jurassic Cock.
Yeah,
Jurassic Cock. Ooh, that sounds good.
Yeah, yeah. And obviously,
I need some of that, Eric.
Obviously, the reason they're titled that is because they're trying to make money off of the original IP. But they're completely different. The only difference is they didn't just use the exact same name because they would get probably sued.
The reason they were able to use the Invisible Man and not give credit to H.G. Wells is probably because copyright law. I don't think his stuff can still be copywritten.
Well, it's probably in the public domain.
That's exactly what that means. Yeah.
But also the other thing too is that it's 130 years later. I think the book was in 1898 or 96 or something like that. So we're talking about seven generations or whatever passed since that was written. And so obviously, same with Frankenstein, right? I mean, Frankenstein, every movie of Frankenstein or Dracula has nothing to do with the book, basically. Mm-hmm. So it's the same principle. I mean, really, when you think about it, I mean, Frankenstein, the movie by Wales, which is considered a classic, is completely different than the book. Completely different.
Right. And I'll go to like a lot of these comic book films. Now, I'm pretty sure anything Marvel related are contractually obligated to put Stan Lee's name on it, even if he had nothing to do with creating the characters. But a lot of them will put in the names of the creators, like, Dave Cockrum for Rocket Raccoon. With Batman, they are legally obligated to put Bob Kane's name in there, but not Bill Finger's. But I think the last couple, they put Bill Finger's name in there. It's just a nice thing to do, right? Is to give credit to the person who created it.
Absolutely. I agree.
Let's be honest, if the Wells estate had any standing to sue them over an Invisible Man movie, they can do that by the fact that they call it the Invisible Freaking Man, right? They don't have to say this isn't, it's got the Invisible Man and the guy named Griffin in it. You're fucked. If you're trying to say it's a completely separate from Wells's story. So if it's out of copyright and they don't have to legally do it, well, okay, fine. But just give the man the credit for it.
Sure. Yeah. And
he's dead. He doesn't care.
Yeah. I mean, even Hollow Man could have been called Invisible Man. Right, because I mean that's the same principle, but a completely different story.
Minutes ago.
Yeah, all right. Well, I probably was away when I.
Yeah, but I mean, it's not like he invented the concept of invisibility, because you had, in mythology, like invisibility, hats and cloaks and underwear or whatever, So the concept of invisibility had been around for a while. He just did a science fiction spin on it.
So was it James Bond? Sorry.
Oh, God, that was terrible. The movie.
All right. Do we want to wrap this up?
We should, because otherwise I'm just going to go on and on and on about things the listeners really don't care about. So let's go.
No way. No,
we haven't been doing that?
All right.
You go. Fuck you, Mike.
I said we.
We've been recording for about 2 hours, final thoughts. And we'll do what we've been watching and all that stuff next time. But before we do our final thoughts, Eric, you do another podcast with your buddy Dan?
I do. It's a general interest podcast called the Askancity Podcast. That's spelled Askancity. You can find it wherever you got this one.
Mike, a new podcast is or returning podcast is coming.
Yeah. So our Cinema a la Carte podcast, which we just recorded an episode about the Disney film Inside Out, and we'll have a forthcoming episode sometime in the next few months about a classic science fiction film. That's taking a hiatus while we bring back Bullets, Brothels, and Bots, which will be covering season 3 of HBO's Westworld. Westworld debuts, I believe, March 15th. So That is a little more than a week away. So in about a week and a half to 2 weeks, we should have the first episode of season 3 of Bullets and Brothels and Bots out for you to listen to with myself and Eric and, of course, Phil trying to pretend that we know what the fuck we're watching.
And Chrissy, you actually have a e-zine project going on?
I do. My magazine is called 34 Orchard. We've got some really visceral, dark fiction. I'm still finishing up. I'm about a week behind on all of my decisions, but I hope to have that done by this weekend. And it's coming out on April 25th. That's a Saturday. It will be available for free as a PDF download at www.34orchard.com. And my book is The Shadows Behind, and you can get that on Amazon. So that's what I've been up to, plus a lot of other stuff, but mostly that. So.
All right. Sounds good. Let's do our final thoughts for this film. So we'll start with you, Chrissy.
Well, I really enjoyed this film. I do think that as a suspenseful thriller, as a suspenseful psychological thriller, it really works. I mean, what I said at the beginning, there's just so much good to like about it. I understand that some people might not go for this or not enjoy it, and that's okay too. I do think it helps. If you know someone who's been through this type of a situation, or if you are in one yourself or were in one in the past, I think it's going to speak a little more strongly to you. I just really think it's well done, and I highly recommend it. And if I definitely think it's worth seeing in the theater, but, you know, it could also make for a wonderful little Friday night rental or a Netflix and chill evening, too. So that's really... That's it. That's all I have to say. Go see it. If you like a nice, tight psychological thriller, then you will like this.
All right. Very good. Eric.
You know, I have been very busy this week, and I haven't really had time to think about this movie before we talked about it tonight. In talking about it tonight, I think I liked it more than I initially thought I did. It's a very good movie. You should go try and catch it in the theater, because we've all been talking about the amazing sound design. So go somewhere with a nice Atmos system if you can. I would be interested in getting this on disc, particularly if there's behind the scenes features. I would love to see how they pulled off all the special effects. This gets a high recommendation from me.
All right, very good. I would concur. This is a really great film. Lee Whannell keeps hitting stuff out of the ballpark. Is curious whether or not he's going to go to big budget films, but if any director is going to, it could be him because of what he's done recently. Interesting article that Mike posted, as we referenced a few times tonight. He said he has no idea if he even would want to, because it would be somewhat different than how he makes great films now. I think that it's going to go that way. But for this film here specifically, it's a gem, and people definitely should check it out, especially if you like suspenseful, tense dramas with thrilling and horror aspects involved. Mike.
Yeah, Eric pointed out this is we're mostly horror vets, and at least some of us here have talked about that we've gotten kind of jaded over the years. So when you get a film that manages to get you a couple of times, get you some jump scares, that's worth noting. This is in the running, and I know it's only March, for my favorite film so far this year. Admittedly, it's been a weak year, but this is almost certainly going to be near the top of my list at the end of the year. And especially Elizabeth Moss' performance, which will, you know, I think we'll get a lot of notice next February for how it was overlooked at the Oscars. And how it didn't get any awards. Fantastic performance, fantastically staged and directed film. It's a horror film, so yes, there may be some little logic gaps here and there in the script, but it does what it's supposed to. It's I found it tense. I found it a great theatrical experience, sort of akin to It Follows or A Quiet Place, in that you're kind of on the edge of your seat for most of the film, and some real just stuff that comes out of left field. And so this I thought was a lot of fun tonight talking about it. It's been great mansplaining to everybody. So I highly recommend everybody go out and catch this as soon as you can, if you haven't already. If you have, go catch it a second time. I'm considering doing that myself.
All right, very good. Just one last thing. One of the articles that Mike, the same article actually that we've been referencing, Lee Whannell talked about how he got the call to do this film because this wasn't his idea. This was kind of a director for hire, but not really. Basically, they called him in, Universal and Blumhouse. Executives, including Blum himself, were there because he thought they were going to talk to him about Upgrade, because they mentioned that specifically in the phone call. And then he gets in and they just drop this invisible man on him and says, "What would you do?" How, and on and on. And then he gave his opinion how he would want to do it, where he came up with, hey, why don't we go with the victim's point of view instead of the invisible man's point of view and make the victim instead of the invisible man. And you know, they said, thank you, whatever. And he left and he was dumbfounded. And then, of course, a week later, they call him and they said they want him to write a script and do this movie. And he had no real interest in the topic until he started writing the script. And the thing is he also mentioned was that the entire interview was really just that interview specific to see, in other words, they pretty much had him as pegged, but they just wanted to see how he would think and talk during the interview with the idea of this project that just dropped on his lap. And so it was kind of an interesting story. It's a really good article. And it's interesting how these things happen and what one film like Upgrade can do to change a person's career and trajectory. So interesting article. Mike, I know you read the article too, and you did Chrissy too. Any further thoughts on that interview process that he had?
No, I really loved that interview, and I would highly recommend that listeners read it. Just because it really shows how much love and thought and care and passion he put into this, and how it was important to him to stick to his guns, you know, and just be like, no, I want to do this way, you know, and to stick to that and to justify everybody and say, I don't really care. You know, this is the way it's doing it. It's my movie. And yet it was the correct choice. You know, because which I find interesting, because a lot of times, like he even says in the article, you know, I'm an artiste, you know, and blah, blah, blah. And it's like sometimes when you let them run amok, like George Lucas with the first three Star Wars films and there's no control, they turn out to be crap. And that's not the case here. I really think this guy has instincts and I think he made a great decision. And I am really going to have my eyes open for his future work. So
yeah. Also, how he talked about Australia, and he decided to film it in Australia because in Australia they know how to stretch the budget. Mike kind of mentioned this earlier, how they can stretch the budget and make things cheap, but make them look really impressive. And he mentioned how Upgrade. He talked a lot about Upgrade, how they made these cars, that futuristic cars, and how they stretched, you know, a budget of $7 million in that film to make this cyberpunk world.
I believe the futuristic car was something like a Civic.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. He said we took this 1980s Honda Civic or something and they made this amazing future car out of it or whatever. It's amazing. Yeah. You know, it was really great stories.
Yeah. And also is another interesting part too is how he talks about how he almost was like felt overwhelmed a bit with James Wan, because James Wan immediately got the credit and success because he was the director, even though he, you know, Whannell wrote most of those films back in the day that Wan directed, and how he did Insidious 3 and he directed it the way Juan did intentionally, because you have to respect the franchise. So if you're hired to do a film that's part of a franchise, you have to follow the franchise. You can't use your artiste way of thinking, because you have to be honest to the franchise. Well, Upgrade was where he was able to use his own voice, and that was where he quote unquote really came out for his own identity. And it's a really good article. It's just a phenomenal interview, I felt, and it's not that long. It was a short article, but it was really cool. So Eric, you did read the article as well, it seems, since you knew about the Civic.
No.
Oh, you didn't. Oh, okay. You
no,
just heard
I got that from the commentary on the movie.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. All right. So, once again, this is Invisible Man 2020 remake or reboot or reinvention of the H.G. Wells book and the Claude Rains film. Part of Universal, but not part of the Dark Universe. Still at theaters now. Not as big of a hit for Blumhouse as some of their films, but most certainly a big money maker, and probably word of mouth will make it last fairly long. I guess people should check it out. And with that stated, Eric, what do you do?
All right, thanks for tuning in. Let's talk about The Invisible Man. Come back next week. We'll have another topic.